Hello, and welcome to Unabashed Book Snobbery, the podcast where we gush about George R. R. Martin's The Song of Ice and Fire and bitch about its poopball adaptation, Game of Thrones.
This is the place where being a book snob is a good thing.
My name is Kylie, and here with me today is Julia.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Of course. You can check out both of our writing on our newly launched website, fandomfollowing.com. And then we also both blog specifically about Game of Thrones and the Song of Ice and Fire on Tumblr. I am GOT Gifts and Musings, and she is the Cultural Vacuum.
Yes, I am. So how's life been treating you lately?
Life's been treating me okay. I don't know. I went into a store the other day. And I swear to God, I'm cursed. And when I went to the store to buy something, that Rape Culture Christmas song was playing.
I love that.
This was the third time I've gone to a store with this specific song playing in like the last week.
I once had an 11-year-old student start singing that song, and I was just like, please don't sing that song anymore. And she was like, why not? And that was a fun time.
And how is this still a song in our culture?
I have no idea. Most people just kind of hear it in the background and they don't really think about it. But usually as soon as you're like, think about what's happening right now. She wants to leave and he won't let her. Then they get that kind of horrified look on her face. But yeah, they keep playing it. I have no idea.
Melodically, it's not the worst. I think that one is All I Want for Christmas Is You. I hate that song.
It's a very catchy song. But that Mariah Carey song of which you speak is not. I kind of ironically really like Bach in Christmas music.
How is that ironic?
Because I'm an atheist.
Ah, I see.
I only like the religious Christmas music.
I like, I think it's a Spanish carol from like the...
Yeah. It sounds Dornish, that's why we like it.
Yes, it's on my Dornish playlist.
So what are we talking about today, Kylie?
Well, I believe today we are continuing our retrospective series, right?
Yes, you and I. This might be new information for you, Kylie, but we've been co-writing a retrospective series on the fifth season of Game of Thrones to really highlight how much it stinks. And we're also in the process of doing a series of podcasts about it. And today we're going to bring you Carol's Landing, which I think we both agree is our favorite so far.
It's absolutely, definitely the most fun. So as we've done for our other episodes, if anyone's listened or if you're just starting to listen today, we are going to start with a quick recap of the plot line. But to give you a warning, even though this is our favorite retrospective and it's definitely not Winter Hell, this is still a plot line with a ton of triggering topics. So today we're going to be talking about rape, child abuse, homophobia, religious straw men. So we just really wanted to give you that warning off the bat.
And this Carol's Landing is also very rich in fandom names. So if you want a full rundown of everything, you should check out the Book Snob Glossary. Just put Book Snob Glossary into Google. I'm sure you'll find it. And we'll also post a link.
Yes, and I'm sure this will be a blog post. Yeah, because we're here for you. We should probably start off with Carol's Landing, shouldn't we?
Well, Carol's Landing is where Carol lives.
Duh.
Yeah. And Carol is our name for the character they call Cersei Lannister on the show, which is odd because she is nothing like Cersei Lannister.
But she's kind of like, she's kind of similar to Carol Brady. Especially with her new haircut.
Yeah. And her brother lover's name is Larry. He's not so smart, but Carol gets him by.
Oh, poor Larry. It's a good thing he has Carol to tell him what to do. Together, they have three kids. Mm-hmm. One of them's dead, so we never gave a fandom name to Joffrey.
I think we called him Chase Lannister.
Chase. And then Marcella was, I think, Madison. But the one we'll be talking about today is poor dumb Tommen. And sometimes we'll say Tom too, but he's just, it's almost as if he was weirdly aged up into a body of a 12 or 13-year-old, but given the mannerisms of an 8-year-old.
That's weird. Yeah. I wonder what could explain that.
Who knows?
And poor Duntamon is married to this very strange creature who we call Marge Boleyn. I got into a fight once on Tumblr about this when I said that Marge is a lot like Anne Boleyn, because I don't mean the historical Anne Boleyn, who is far more interesting. I mean, like, the Anne Boleyn that is kind of in the popular imagination, this kind of scheming sexual person who's all about basically grabbing power and has this whole scheming family behind her.
She never really existed in history.
Yeah, she never really existed in history, but she exists on TV.
Right. So. And Marge Boleyn's brother is the Knight of the Fabulous, who we will call Fabs. And this is, just to be very absolutely clear,
this is another thing
this
we got in trouble for.
So this is the character Loras Tyrell, and he's gay, and somehow Benioff and Weiss, the showrunners, have stripped him down to being absolutely nothing but his sexual predilection. He has no personality, so we really wanted to kind of...
Well, he's kind of grumpy.
Yeah, I guess he's a little grumpy. He's a little pissy. But we really, this is our way of highlighting what we consider to be incredibly problematic treatment of him. So this is not our way of reinforcing homophobia. It's our way of calling attention to it. And just to be absolutely clear, it's a topic that's incredibly, like, we take it very seriously.
Yeah. What else do we have? We have, Maggie the Fox, who only shows up for one scene, but she makes quite an impression.
And she's
super hot.
She's got
really nice teats.
She came off stage singing Lovely Ladies in Les Mis, and then she came right over to Game of Thrones and started filming.
Yeah. And, we have the High Grandpa, who's the head of the Sparrow Movement. He just kind of walks around with no shoes on.
Yeah, and the Sparrow Movement we also sometimes call the Faith Taliban.
Yeah.
We might call them Sparrows. We go back and forth. It's the Great Dictator Effect, you know?
Yeah.
So, they're a bunch of religious strawmen that run around
smashing things.
Faith smash.
But they have one member who is absolutely awesome, and who is that, Kylie?
Oh, is that Septa Spoonella?
With my hero.
Spoon of Dune. And she's technically a combination of three Septas from the books, and I think her name is supposed to be Unella, but she's Spoonella. Too bad.
She has a spoon. I mean, that's how it works. Spoon. And then we also have Batfinger, who you know from some previous retrospectives.
Yes, that's Littlefinger with his Batman voice, of course.
Yes, and his partner in crime, the Dowager Countess, Olenna.
Yeah, we'll probably just call her Olenna, but she's...
Yeah, we usually do.
A sassy Dowager Countess.
Yeah, they very consciously based, like, both of the Tyrell ladies on other successful characters and other successful TV shows. One of whom was played by the same actor. Very strange.
Yeah. Is that a coincidence?
I don't know.
All right.
So, what were all these people up to?
Well,
in Carol's Landing.
Everything in Carol's Landing begins with Carol. And I don't know if you guys remember, but the very first scene, not just of this plotline, but of the season, was a flashback to young Carol and her friend, let's call her Megan, because we never learn her name.
Her name is Malara Heatherspoon, right?
Well, yes, but did they tell us that?
I don't think so.
They go into a tent with Maggie the Fox, who's really hot. And they're like, tell us our fortunes. And Maggie the Fox is like, okay, I will tell you part of your fortune.
Only half of it.
You will have three kids and they'll probably die. And then there's going to be this, like, hot young woman that casts you, that casts
Yeah, and you'll
your
become
side.
Queen.
Yeah.
You forgot that part.
And, oh, and Robert's going to philander.
Yes, because he's going to have 20 children and she's going to have three.
Yeah, so it was just a very neutered scene.
Yeah, I think we'll get into it a little more later, but
we've got a lot to go through. We can't focus on Megan the Fox.
Yeah. Okay, so the next scene is Carol in her box, her cool box that she moves around the city in. Symbolic. And she's going to Tywin's funeral because you may or may not remember Tywin died in the season finale of season 4.
Tyrion killed him.
Yeah, Tyrion killed him. So she has stink eyes with Marge, and then she goes into the sept where his, like, beer is, and Larry's there, and they have what we call a non-versation.
Yeah, a non-versation is a very common thing in this plotline especially, and it's when two people in Game of Thrones stand near each other and talk and say things, but they don't line up and they don't react to what they're actually saying.
Yeah, it's like two separate, like, kind of monologues happening simultaneously, and they usually take turns.
Yeah, so actually this one was really cute, because Carol was, like, monologuing about responsibility, and Larry was, like, monologuing about, like, my enemies are coming to kill me.
It's like they were role-playing as each other. It was like a couples therapy thing.
Yeah, it was really cute.
Yeah. And then after that is the drunken wake.
That was pretty awesome. It was just Carol walking around drinking wine because everyone around her is being annoying. Like, Fabs is in the background being
they're still engaged at this point, right?
Yeah. And Fabs, like, forgets how words work. And
he starts talking drivel about, like, your father was so cool, man. Cool.
What an important figure. Yeah, and then Kevin Lannister, I don't know if you guys remember, but who cares? It's just Carol's uncle, pops in and he's like, you're a woman, and I'm Kevin, and I'm awful.
Yeah, well, he apologizes for his son Lancel's appearance because his son has gotten all, like, hippie.
His son has gotten hot.
he is very hot, but he's also a hippie now. He, like, has a shirt.
It's like, new shoes, man. I feel closer to nature.
Yeah. Can we talk about his man cleavage?
It's pretty epic. It's
yeah,
a very good amount of cleavage. Maybe the most man cleavage we've gotten on this show.
Well, as you may or may not remember, way back in season one, Lancel and Carol were fucking. And Lancel
was it season one or season two? I don't even remember when they whitewashed it out.
No, one of the last scenes of season one was him. Like, we got a butt shot of him, I remember.
That's right.
Yeah. And I think it was, like, implied to be going on all the way from season two, because then Tyrion blackmailed him.
Right,
they actually kept that, and there's that whole thing just like, you know, please ask Lord Tyrion to kill me if I should speak again or whatever.
Yes.
But he decides to go up to Carol and start slut-shaming her. He's all like, I forgive you for your horrible sin. She was like, what? He's like, remember when you had me kill your husband? And she's like, no.
Carol,
no, I don't remember that, Lancel.
Here's the thing you need to know about us. Like, we should have mentioned this off the gate, but Carol is our problematic fave.
Yes, absolutely.
And frankly, she's not that problematic this year.
No.
But she's our fave because she really is a great, compelling character who doesn't take shit from assholes like this.
Yeah.
So when he comes up and is, like, trying to slut-shame her and, like, bring it up, she just has this, like, wonderful, bemused look on her face. Like, you really trying to pull this with me?
Yeah. I know, she doesn't seem to react to the whole, like, I killed your husband thing.
She gives a Carol face.
Yeah, I guess, but she seems very mellow, maybe because she's so drunk.
She's just happy and Carol.
Yeah, so in the next scene, you got Fabs and his boyfriend Olivar, and they're learning about Dorne. They're having a very important Dorne astrography lesson.
Right, where Olivar thinks that Sunspear is named, like, Spiky Stone.
No, it was Sandstone. He couldn't figure out the name of Sandstone.
Oh, God.
He thought it was called, like, Sandspear or something.
Sandspear?
I don't know. And so then March comes in when they're, like, making out. And yeah. She's all like, we're late for dinner, dude. Then what happens?
Oh, right. Yeah, she's like, we're late for dinner. I'm so hungry. And she's so relatable. And all these, like, bowls of fruit around her won't apparently quell her appetite. But then she orders Olivar out. And I don't know. She and Fabs are just kind of like, the Lannisters suck. And Marge basically goes, yeah, well, perhaps Carol won't be around to be a problem. And Fabs, perhaps. And Marge holds a flashlight under her chin and goes, perhaps.
And then it's our favorite scene. It's your highlight from the porn plot, which was the snake in a box scene.
Yeah, it's another, it's actually a conversation this time between Larry and Carol. Yeah, it's a good scene.
More or less.
Yeah, Carol got a threatening message, a snake in a box, and then she
Carol is super worried about Marcella.
Yeah, and she sets the snake in the box back up for Larry.
She cares. Okay?
We've already talked about this. She's very, very worried about Madison. Mm-hmm. And then Larry offers to go get Madison, and she's like, I don't think this is gonna work. And he's all, no, I need to make it better. And she's, okay, fine, I guess. Yeah. And, yeah. It's our poor tiger
she's
mom.
She's so patient. She's so patient with Larry, and she's so patient with the randos who come with severed heads.
Yeah, it's very true.
That's the next scene. Somebody brings her because she put like a price on Tyrion's head, like literally. But then these guys come with the head of a random other unfortunate little person, and it's the wrong one. And she's like, oh, it's okay. Mistakes will be made. I think that was the actual line.
Yeah, she says, it's okay, mistakes will be made, I don't want to discourage the other hunters. And Kyra's just like, can I take the head? And she's like, okay.
For science. Yeah, she's so nice. She's so understanding.
Yeah, she would never threaten them or, yeah.
Yeah, have their noses cut off.
Can you take the small council meeting? Because I love your take.
Okay, so next, Carol walks into the small council meeting, and she goes to the head of the table, and she sits in the big chair, where Tywin used to sit. And her Uncle Kevin is like, WTF, what are you doing here? Are you the hand of the king? She's like, well, no, of course not. I'm a woman. I can't be the hand of the king. I'm just going to rule. Okay? And he's like, I don't like this. And then she's
because
like,
I'm
well,
Kevin,
this is Qyburn.
I'm a misogynist.
And he's our new master of whispers. And then Pycelle is like, oh my gosh, blah, blah, blah. And he's all like, you know, Pycelle-like. And then Mace is like, hey, I can be the hand of the king. She's like, no, 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 Mace. You can't be the hand of the king because you're going to be too busy with your new job as master of coin because you're super duper essential to this administration, man. Okay?
And she's really good at puffing him up.
Yeah, because he's, you know, he's Mace. So, yeah. So she soothes his ego. She gets Pycelle to calm down. She makes a very good argument about Qyburn because his predecessor kind of committed treason and then quit. So her argument is like, he's very loyal. It's kind of persuasive. But then Kevin just loses his shit. And what does Kevin say, Kylie?
I do not recognize your authority. You are Queen Mother. Nothing more.
And then he stomps off in a huff and she's just
because
like...
Because he's a misogynist.
Because yeah. He's a misogynist. And she's just like, oh, the things I have to deal with. That glass ceiling.
Yeah, she's just trying to rule the kingdom.
I know, she's just trying to, like, you know, like, make her most important ally feel important, even though he's completely useless. She has kept, you know, Grandmaster Pycelle on the council. She has her Uncle Kevin on the council. And she has, you know, a Master of Whispers who she's appointed because she couldn't appoint the old one because, you know, he committed treason and ran off. And, like, this is her father's small council. I don't know what Kevin is complaining about.
He said she was stuffing it with sycophants because she had appointed Qyburn to Master of Whispers. Literally, yeah. Varys quit, and that was the only replacement she made.
Yeah. Pycelle was still... He was still there. She was willing to give him actual power. And Mace was still there, and everybody knew that they couldn't get rid of him because he had, like, all the food. So... Yeah.
Yeah.
And basically, his criticisms are not reasonable. That is our point.
Yeah. He said he wanted Tommen to be ruling. And then Carol said, well, no, Tommen's not of age yet. Interesting, because then the next scene is Tommen getting married to Marge. And then
they play the Baratheon theme.
They play the Baratheon theme, and then it cuts to Tommen's sex noises, which I never want to hear this actor's sex noises again.
No.
And
do we have to talk about this in detail?
No, I mean, Marge rapes Tommen, and then Tommen's, like, acting like he's a little excitable boy who just, like, found someone to play Pokemon with.
Yeah.
And that's how it's played.
We're going to talk about it a little more later. I just kind of want to gloss over it because it gets me really riled up.
Yeah.
All right. So then the day after that, Carol is talking to Tom. Mm-hmm. They're like going for a walk on the battlements. And she's just like, so your new wife, she's really dumb. And Tommen is like, you should go to Casterly Rock now.
Right after the rape, Marge tried to compel Tommen to send his mother away. That's where that came from.
Yeah. Well, she was kind of all like trying to be all suave and seductive about it or something. I don't know.
We'll get into it later.
Yeah. And then after that emotional blow of her son trying to send her away, she goes to see her new daughter-in-law.
Good daughter, yeah.
Her new good daughter. And she walks in just as Marge is giggling and gossiping with her girlfriends about what a noob her 12-year-old husband is at sex. And they're all giggling about it. And then she turns around, she sees her, and she's like, Carol, hi! We don't have any wine because it's too early for us. That's like the first thing she says.
It was just they were acting at Mean Girls. There's nothing else to this scene. And Carol kind of tried to intimidate her and actually did because, let's be honest, Carol is terrifying when she needs to be. But it was just Mean Girls. And literally the scene ends with Carol walking away and they're all dissolving into giggles at Carol's expense. Yeah. Oh, you take the next scene. It's your favorite.
Okay, so the next scene is kind of the introduction of another kind of plot thread in this plot line. The High Septon, whom we saw at the wedding and we saw briefly at the funeral, is in Littlefinger's establishment. Can you do establishment in that voice that he does?
Establishment.
Thank you. So they're in that establishment.
The finest establishment.
The High Septon is choosing for this buffet of six sex workers who are dressed up as six of the gods. And then Olivar, who's Fab's boyfriend, is standing there dressed up as the father.
He's in full clothing, of course.
He's in full clothing, of course. And the High Septon has, like, these pantaloons on. And these, like, seven sex workers are, like, just walking around him in a circle while he's, like, thinking about which one of them to select. And the camera... we'll talk about what the camera does later. But then what happens is... Just as he's about to get it on.
You mean the crotch shots?
We'll talk about it later, Kylie. Don't get me worked up. So just as the old dude is about to get it on, the Faith Talibon comes smashing in, and they grab him, and Lancel is there, and Lancel is, like, up in his face, and he's like, you're like a blight on the faith.
Julia,
and-
this sounds like a dream that you had about A Song of Ice and Fire that you're describing. And I think Lancel was there, and he bludgeons him in the face.
Yeah, do they strike him in the face? I know they strike Oliver in the face.
I don't
like,
know.
There's two episodes in a row where the Faith Talibon breaks into the brothel and hits Oliver. So they drag the High Septon out into the street and they strip him naked. And they force him to walk down the street. Like, they don't even let him cover up his genitals. There was this whole thing where he's trying to cover up his genitals with his hand and they, like, start hitting his arms. So he's walking down the street naked.
But don't worry, the camera crops out the genitals.
We'll talk about that later. He's walking down the street naked and all the denizens of Carol's Landing start laughing at him. And then the High Septon goes to see the Small Council, and he's just like, I refuse to be slut-shamed by these fanatics. And nobody seems to care at all about his plight, except for Pycelle, which is like an in-joke, right? Because Pycelle is really into the sex workers, too. Ha-ha.
Yeah, yeah, it was all self-serving for him.
Yeah.
It's like, there should be precedent for old creeps to have. Yeah.
But Carol is intrigued by his mention of the leader of these Faith Taliban thug guys, who he calls the High Sparrow, but who we call the High Grandpa, because he's everybody's grandpa.
Yeah, and so then Carol goes to seek out High Grandpa, and...
She doesn't seek him out. They go on a date, okay? They go on a date to the soup kitchen, like in Dr. Harville's sing-along blog.
It's kind of awesome as she's walking up to him, where she's like holding potpourri in her hand and smelling it, and it's actually pretty awesome, because we can almost project the book onto it. But she shows up and it's, you know, Elliot Carver from Tomorrow Never Dies. I can't see him as anything else.
I can't see him as anything but Bernie Sanders.
He kind of does look like Bernie Sanders.
He even has like that hair flip thing going on.
And she chats with him and she's like, the High Septon was really upset with how you treated him. Like, this is ridiculous. And he goes, I know, those guys went too far. I'm totally not into violence. I'm the High Grandpa. Free love, man. So then,
we're all equal in the eyes of the seven, man.
Yeah, so Carol likes that, and then runs to Qyburn's office and says, send a raven to Batfinger.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently these thoughts are connected.
Yeah, she has like a fire loon under her feet. Like, she's in a real rush to get this message to Batfinger.
Yeah, and we'll obviously cover that a lot later. Oh, also, Qyburn is working on something. He's got, like, we think it's Gregor who's, like, flopping around on his table. But all we see him doing is dissecting a rat, so.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, he's not very good at it because the blood spatters all over him. He doesn't have proper dissection technique.
No.
And then there's another small council meeting. And Carol is acting very wise, which she's... They have this problem where basically they owe a lot of money to the Iron Bank of Braavos. So she says, okay, Mace, you're the master coin. You have to go to Braavos and take care of this.
Oh, and of course, she can't pay it off herself because the Lannister gold mines are empty.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't really mention that.
But we know this in the canon, Julia.
Yeah, but she has this huge smile on her face. And she's like, I'm sending you to Braavos and you get your own Knight of the Kingsguard. And then Meryn Trant comes out and there's this, like, music.
It's like, dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
And then they leave. They go off, and he's on his extremely essential diplomatic mission.
And then if you thought this made sense up until now, which it kind of did.
Yeah, I mean, she's acting very well. I mean...
Right. So then the next scene is Carol, and she's in a meeting with the High Grandpa, and they're flirting again.
Mm-hmm. About... They're flirting over how he's a teetotaler.
Yeah, and he's like, I don't drink wine because I just don't like it.
Yeah.
And then she says, you know what would be fun? You should... What if we armed the Faith?
Yeah, because like, Carol has heard on the grapevine that the Faith is in a lot of trouble with, like, the war and everything. And wouldn't it be nice if they had some way to defend themselves?
No one mentioned this, by the way.
Yeah, nobody mentioned this beforehand. And, you know, she's so wise and she's so in touch that she knew about it. And High Grandpa was like, okay, sounds great.
This sounds great. Thanks, Carol. Yeah. You're the best tiger mom. Can I have an orange slice?
You can have two.
And then the newly armed Faith Taliban, step one, they carve the seven-pointed star into their temples in,
it's
like, an
squicky.
Uruk-hai getting ready for battle montage.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, it's very evocative of that.
They just
and it's squicky. I mean, we should have had a trigger warning for squickiness.
Yeah, it really is. This was Dave Hill's episode. I feel like I need to point that out. Then the Faith Taliban run around King's Landing, smashing shit, and
they smash idols and barrels of beer. I think establishments.
Don't they go and they drag someone out of Batfinger's establishment who's gay? Yep. Yeah.
Yes, that's the second time they punch Oliver in the face.
They punch Oliver in the face, and then we learn about their anti-gay agenda. Oh, and then they go and they arrest Fabs.
Yes, they arrest Fabs. No, because back in the meeting, we kind of skipped over this, back in the meeting with the High Grandpa, Carol is like, what if I told you that there is this guy who is like really important and totally gay? Would you be interested in this information?
And we think this is why she armed the Faith.
Yeah. Specifically to get Fabs arrested.
And arrested he does. He becomes. Which leads to the next scene of Marge screaming at her abuse victim husband.
He just wants to eat his lunch.
So then he goes to talk to Carol about it because it's not like Marge could do anything herself, I guess.
Yeah. She can't talk to other women, I guess. I don't know. That's like a law, right? Like, you're only allowed to talk to men, right?
Well, it's a law of Weisseroff.
Okay. I'm trying to just think up some reason for why I shouldn't talk to Carol herself.
Honeypots will have to come later, dude.
So then poor Duntommen goes into his box and he goes to the Sept and he wants to see the High Grandpa.
Well, no, but first Carol tells him to go do that.
Right. Because she
stops giving a shit.
Yeah, he goes to his mom and she's just like, well, I didn't do anything. All I did was give them weapons. Okay? This
no
is
idea
not
what
my
happen.
Problem. Why don't you go talk to the High Grandpa? You can take care of it, dude. Okay, you're like the king. So, yeah, he goes in his box and he goes to see the High Grandpa. But the Faith Taliban guys at the entrance, like, send him to voicemail. They're like, nope, the High Grandpa's busy right now.
And everyone on the streets is suddenly mad at Tommen and like, you're a bastard, even though, like, 3 episodes ago they were so happy with him.
No, that was the episode before when they got married.
Oh, yeah, the episode before. Whoops, sorry. Mm-hmm.
And they were cheering in the streets, yeah. Then he goes to tell his wife/abuser this, that he can't talk to the High Grandpa right now. And she's, like, so disappointed, man.
Oh, yeah, she's really upset. And then she basically tells him he's sleeping on the couch tonight. And she storms out, and she's, I need to get my grandmother. Because, well, actually, she says, I need to get some fan services, I think.
Yeah.
The exact
one. One of the two. You can't really tell sometimes. And then there's an episode without any Carol's Landing, and it's the most boring episode of the series as far as...
Oh, is that the warm milk episode?
Yeah. Kill the Boy.
Kill the Boy, where we're at Winterhell forever. Mm.
And then in episode 6, Batfinger magically appears.
He flies in, and he and Lancel have this kind of epic showdown where it's another non-versation, but we're pretty sure the entire thing was crafted around him going, we both peddle fantasies, brother Lancel.
Yeah, and just Lancel just says that the Faith Taliban have completely taken over the city.
He says it's a new Carol's Landing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's the scene where Batfinger meets with Carol, and it makes so much sense.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
The majority of our discussion is probably going to be about this scene.
Yeah, so just so, very, very quickly, yeah. Carol says, do you have my back if there's war? Do the Knights of the Vale have my back? And Batfinger goes, of course, because that's the only way I even have my seat. Then she goes, if that's all, I'm going to dismiss you. And he goes, wait, one more thing. Sansa Stark is going to marry Ramsay Bolton, and we need to send an army to stop them. And Stannis is coming and they're all going to fight for Winterfell and then we need to send an army to sweep them out afterwards. And Carol goes, oh no, I don't have an army because Larry's useless and Kevin's a misogynist. And Batfinger goes, well, I'd go. And she goes, okay, I'll give you a warden of the North, but you need to kill Sansa. Deal. Yay.
Yay.
Confused? You should be. Whatever.
And then Elena arrives.
Of course she does.
Yeah, and she stops her wheelhouse just so she can talk about how it smells and then she moves on.
Well, she literally goes, why are we stopped?
Yeah, well, she says, stop the carriage. Then she opens the window and says,
you can
it
smell
stinks.
Shit from
closes
a mile away.
Closes the window
away.
And says, why are we stopped? They probably built the wheelhouse just for that scene, too. You don't understand. They probably built the entire wheelhouse just for that scene.
Halt! You can smell it. Yeah, she does say halt. Okay, great. We had a check. We're this thorough here on unabashed book snubbery.
So, and then Elena has, first she has a meeting with Marge where they talk about how they're homophobic.
Oh yeah, Renly was fucking every stable boy and no one said mm-hmm. boo, because apparently Renly was now fucking every stable boy.
And, yeah, that's well established.
And thank you for reinforcing the promiscuous gay stereotype paternity. Yeah.
Because,
okay.
Yeah, in the show, he is never portrayed as being even remotely interested in anyone but Loras. So, why not make him fuck every stable boy in King's Landing?
It's fine. Then she goes to meet with, she goes to meet with Carol next, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And Carol is writing.
Carol's trying to pull a Tywin, and I think it's supposed to be framed like Elena's not letting her get away with it, but then Carol legitimately has good points, because she just says, I can't do anything about this. I didn't arrest him. What do you want from me? Mm-hmm. And then Elena's like, well, maybe I'll blow up our alliance. And Carol goes, well, what would that even do? Like, that would just hurt everyone. And why don't we just go to this inquest?
Yeah.
So you need to take the inquest.
I don't think I can. Okay. So in the inquest, all of a sudden the High Grandpa is a lawyer and he's questioning Loras, and Loras denies everything.
He's a lawyer, isn't he?
What is he charged with? He's charged with blasphemy,
buggery
and something.
High treason? No, it couldn't have been.
No. I remember blasphemy and buggery. There was another one. There were three.
Fornication.
Fornication, yes.
Because that's a charge.
Well, yeah. It can be, I guess. Okay, so Loras denies everything. Fabs. Why did I call him Loras? Fabs. Denies everything. Loras is actually an interesting person, and Fabs is just a cardboard cutout. So... and then all of a sudden, Grandpa is like, hey, Marge, we want you to testify. And Marge is like, no, I'm the queen. I don't have to testify. And he's like, yeah, you do. And this is apparently persuasive. He just said it. So of course it's true. So then Marjorie perjures herself for some reason.
Yeah. Well, they set up a perjury trap. Like, it's very obvious what they're doing. They set up a perjury
trap. Carol definitely knows about it.
Yeah. Carol has this look on her face the whole time. Like, ooh, the good part's coming. And then Oliver gets brought in, and the questions they ask him make it obvious that he's, like, they set the trap for both Marge and Loras.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
He just says, I did sleep with Loras.
Yeah.
And Marge knows. And they go, do you have any proof? And he goes, yes. There is sandstone on Loras's thigh.
Yeah, he has a birthmark shaped.
There's
like
stone spear.
Yeah. Which is, there are so many reasons why that's stupid.
Because squires don't see their...
Yeah, knights, but he says that he was Fabs' squire.
This right. is all really dumb. Yeah, and so then Marge and Fabs get led away to
yeah,
be shackled.
Yeah, so they arrest Fabs for being gay, and they arrest Marjorie for being an ally.
Yeah, and Tommen and Elena sit there looking stunned, and then yeah. Carol's just grinning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah... So, I guess our sassy dowager didn't want to let that sit, because Elena goes to seek out the High Grandpa, and then they kind of, like, old people flirt with each other.
Yeah, they're talking about, like, which of their joints are decrepit.
Yeah, and then she's basically all, hey, release my grandson, because there's all these gay people, you can't lock them all up, and High Grandpa's all, the hell I can.
Yeah, he, like, is really into, like, biblical literalism or something.
Yeah, it's bizarre, and then he basically says... You can't do shit. She threatens to cut off, I don't know, food or something.
Yeah, the same thing she threatened with Carol.
Yeah, and High Grandpa basically says the small folk are going to overthrow you, so shut the fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
He's
like a Marxist or something.
And then she gets summons from Batfinger.
Yeah, she's outside seal. On the street and she gets this giant seal. And then what happens? There's a touching scene. There's a touching scene with Tom and Carol first.
Tom Tom's really, really sad that he couldn't save his lady wife abuser from her fate. So he gets really mad and he actually starts saying, like, I'll kill them all or something. Toxically masculine, because that's how he is.
He wants to impress his wife.
And Carol is just such a good tiger mom. Mm-hmm. And we're probably using that term wrong. She's just a good mom. And she pulls
she's
him
a super
in.
Mom.
She's so warm and she hugs him and presses his face to her face and it's like, and basically sings, you know, not while I'm around to him. So.
Yeah, you're the most important thing in the world to me. You and your sister.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of show tunes, we then have empty beds and empty bottles.
There is literally a minute and a half of Batfinger walking through his brothel while nostalgic sad music plays. Literally. Like, I'm not
over-exaggerating. It was the finest establishment.
Yeah, and then Alen is there.
He says that they invented sex, and Alen's like, why did you bring me here?
Yeah, he, like, brags for another, like, 30 seconds about how wonderful his brothel is. And she's just like, are we going to talk about how, like, your employee set up my grandchildren? And he's like, well, you know, I didn't have a choice because Carol is so scary. And Alana's like, remember the part where we assassinated the king together? I have shit on you.
I'm going to tell everyone about that. If I go down, you're going with me. She says something like that.
Yeah. And Batfinger is like, you know, we can make a deal. And so then they agree to be BFFs because Batfinger is going to give her a handsome young man.
Handsome young man.
And it's very mysterious.
Yeah. Then we cut to Carol visiting Marge in prison. Mm-hmm. And Marge is, like, not looking good. She basically is doing the equivalent of throwing her shit at Carol. I don't even remember this scene. She calls her a vile scheming bitch, which is from the books, but it makes no sense in this context because she was the one scheming. Mm-hmm. So. And Carol kind of looks horrified. Kind of. Like, you're really trying to give me the upper hand? You fucking abused my son?
Yeah. But then when Marge is all like, oh, he loves me more than he loves you.
Yeah.
So she doesn't exactly have the moral high ground.
Yeah, and then when Carol leaves the cell, she just starts grinning. It's so badly done. But I guess her joy turns to ash in its mouth because then the high grandpa shows up with his trap of doom.
Yeah, well, she goes into the high grandpa's favorite, like, Spartan chapel. And he's, like, tells her about, like, the history of Protestantism in the Faith of the Seven or something. And he's all like, you know, you can't hide from the faith. I can't summarize it because it just makes a little sense. It was just a monologue about, like, aestheticism, basically, in asceticism in religion and how it's wonderful. Yeah. And then he's like, he suddenly produces Evil Ansel. Because apparently Evil Ansel told her all about the, like, sad sex they had a couple of times.
Only now. Only now he saw fit to confess to this. And he might have mentioned killing Robert. I don't know.
Yeah, I think they do mention that later on. So then Carol tries to run away, but she opens the door, and oh my god, who's there?
It's Septa Spinella!
Septa Spinella!
It's Septa Spinella, and the next scene that we get is in Hard Home, and Septa Spinella is the most terrifying part of this episode, because Carol is in a cell looking not good, and they're withholding water from her until she confesses, but we just get these awesome, intimidating, like, low-angle shots of Spinella with, like, light behind her so you can't really see her face, but not a lot of light. She's just holding up the spoon and going, confess. And that's all she will say, and then when Carol gets sassier, when Carol threatens her, she'll, like, slap her. And
slap her with a spoon.
There's two or three scenes of this. Like, they're legitimately killing Carol. There's a scene.
She's gonna die of dehydration.
Yeah, she drinks dirty water off the floor because she's going to
then,
die.
Then Qyburn comes visit her, and we learn several things. We learn that she's being charged. We learn exactly what she's being charged with, right?
Yes. She's charged with high treason. She's charged with fornication.
And adultery. Incest. And the murder of King Robert.
Fornication, treason, incest, the murder of King Robert.
Yeah. So are they charging her with... they're charging her with incest with Larry, right? Not with Lancel, because they kind of make it seem like cousin sex is taboo.
They do make it seem like that, because... Yeah. Yeah, High Sparrow goes, your cousin, later on. Yeah. But, No, I'm pretty sure it's with Larry.
And also that they've heard no news from Larry. They learned that, and that makes her sad. And Kevin is back in the city, but he won't see her because he's horrible. And that makes her sad. And Tom has locked himself in his room and he won't eat.
And that makes her sad too. Yeah. Eventually she just decides she can't take all the sadness and dehydration, so she agrees to confess.
Mm-hmm. And she has this conversation with the high grandpa that's actually kind of sort of a book scene.
But it, again, makes no sense in this context. They also had a retcon in her crimes. She admits to sleeping with Lancel, but then she says it was while Robert was alive, which... That is high treason, and I don't think they realized that she just confessed to high treason.
Yeah, like, queen having adultery is a huge deal.
Yeah, that's the one thing she did not confess to, and she was very careful to not confess to anything treasonous in the books like that.
She confessed to, like, fornication after she was widowed, but not...
Yeah.
Not anything while Robert was still alive.
Exactly. But that's all she confesses to. She says the incest is a lie. She says the murder is a lie. And then High Grandpa tells her, okay, you'll be free to go after I slut shame you.
Yeah. And that there's going to be a trial, too. He mentions that.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. You know.
And then there's like a minute.
Due process, yo.
Yeah. There's a minute and a half, again, of her being like manhandled by nuns. Or her body double, rather.
They give her a haircut, but they like cut out a chunk of her head.
Yeah, it's like the whole thing. Like, they're being just so unnecessarily rough with her. They're like, you know, when they turn her around so they can like shave the back of her head, whatever, they're just like, you know, yanking her around and just like pulling her everywhere and grabbing her and pushing her. It's like, why are you being so rough?
And then she sits and she sings I Dreamed a Dream because it looks exactly like the same lighting as when Anne Hathaway sang it.
They probably did that on purpose.
I think so. Because that, didn't that win a, yeah, whatever. And then it's the Walk of Shame.
Yeah. It's the Walk of Shame. And, we'll be talking quite a bit about it later.
And Spinella takes over Scalera's duties of ringing the bell.
Yeah. She's got some mad beats.
She's a talented septa, and we'll definitely be talking about this, and there's, you know, the body double and the floating bobblehead issue, and it's, yeah. we'll be talking about it, trust me.
We'll be talking about it.
She ends the walk inside the Red Keep, and then Pycelle and Kevin are standing there looking kind of pervy.
Yeah,
actually.
Well, Kevin doesn't look pervy, but Pycelle
does. He's got this, like...
I don't know what they did to that character, but Kevin is just kind of standing there, like, you know...
This is happening.
Yeah. He
and then
seem to give a shit.
So Qyburn's the one who, like, comes and rescues her.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Our notes say he rescues her with a smurf. What are you talking about, Julia?
The giant blue guy.
Oh, my God. I thought you were calling, like, the blanket a smurf.
So he has, like a Lannister houseguard cloak that he wraps her in. And then he introduces her to Sir Robert Strong, who's... like this giant 8-foot-tall man with a blue face, and he doesn't speak, and
no one's concerned that he has a blue face.
He just kind of picks her up and he carries her off, and then the plot line is over, and that only took us 40 minutes.
It's over.
All right, so what a story, Mark.
Yeah, that was really something.
It's okay, because we're really not going to be recapping the books in the detail that we were for the other retrospectives, just because it's, you'll see. But as we've done with our others, let's talk about highlights and lowlights. So, Julia, your highlight?
Well, my highlight will have to be the Walk of Shame, just because I can't think of anything else, really. And I have this pattern now of having a highlight that is basically a scene where I am able to project the book onto it enough so I can actually enjoy it. I mean, the first time I watched the episode, I was very affected by it. And then, like, as I thought about it more, I was a little less enthused by how it was all done. And you know, the big problem is definitely the body double, and just kind of, for some reason, they had to have their extended full frontal nudity. And
it's crucial.
Yeah, it was crucial. And they ended up with a special effect that is less and less convincing the more you look at it.
Try gift capping it. Yeah. Holy shit.
That was an experience. But it's mostly like the book. If you just ignore the fact that you just watched an entire season and you just think that, you know, this is maybe like, I don't know, a fan film that somebody made of that particular scene in the book, then it works quite well. It's a little, I don't know, I don't think that it focuses enough on Cersei/Carol and her kind of inward journey through the entire thing, because in the book it's all about...
The whole thing I was waiting to see were the faces of the people that she had wronged in the past, but then I remembered Carol didn't do anything.
She didn't wrong anyone. But yeah, basically Cersei's walking through the city naked, and she's kind of horrified by her own body, because Cersei is a misogynist, basically. Mm-hmm. But she puts a lot of her own value on how hot she is, like how much men desire her. And so she's walking through the streets naked, and everyone is, you know, pelting her with fruit and calling her a whore or whatever. And she looks down and she sees that, like, you know, she's aging. She has stretch marks and her boobs are kind of saggy. You know, she's had 3 kids. And she's just, like, so horrified by the idea that maybe she's not the most beautiful woman in the world.
And of course, it's also the whole internal projecting onto her external thing. We're not saying that, you know, post children, women post childbirth are unattractive.
It's, no,
that's her view of it because she's a misogynist.
Yeah, well, she believes that the only value that a woman can possibly have is her physical beauty, and right. since you know she's in her mid-30s, so she's not you know perky teenager with perky boobs or whatever. She feels that she herself has diminished in value.
It's almost as if there is a self-fulfilling prophecy about someone younger and hotter casting her down, and that was her biggest fear. We don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're also missing the faces because she sees faces of people.
She sees Ned. She sees Lady and Sansa.
Yeah, she sees Melara Heatherspoon, who she pushed down a well when she was 10. Well, yeah. It's very strongly implied that at the very least, she fell down a well and Cersei did nothing to save her.
Yeah, but young Carol did not do anything to Meghan.
So it's really only my highlight because I read the books, and the scene in the books is extremely effective and extremely challenging. And there's enough of it there that I can pretend it's the scene from the books. And that makes me slightly less miserable.
You know, I think I'm actually in projection fun times with you for my favorite scene. Because mine is basically just anything involving Septa Spinella.
We have a thing for Septas. It's kind of weird.
We really do. Julia and I, in particular, have a very bizarre thing about the faith and women
yeah,
in the faith.
I wrote an entire 80,000-word fanfic about a Septa.
Septa Eglantine.
Yeah, and you wrote that definitive ranking of Septas, which is epic.
I did do the definitive ranking of Septas. And it's just, I think the intersection of the patriarchy and women's kind of relegation into the Septa, like, order and all that is just always intrinsically interesting.
Yeah, but also, their historical analogs within our universe, you know, the nuns in the Catholic Church, they... Like, it's a place where women have some kind of power, but it's also a place where they're relegated from power.
Yeah, so don't get me wrong. I do think Spinella was exaggerated and a bit cartoonish with the dehydration. Like, that's ridiculous.
And the manhandling.
She was also awesome in that role and really intimidating. And I am serious. She scared me more than anything that happened at Hardhome. Far more.
Yeah.
So that was definitely my highlight. But again, I don't know if that's me projecting the book and what I would have hoped that looked like, you know.
Lowlights?
Lowlights. You do yours.
Okay, so my lowlight is definitely the scene with the 7 kinky gods. Like, it's impossible to describe. Like, when you watch the scene, you'll know exactly what I mean. It's like the director goes out of his way to objectify these 6 models.
And we say his in the certainty because there were no women directors.
We don't even have to check. But, yeah, basically, like, you see them in all the shots, you see from their neck to their knees and nothing else.
And there's one particular shot where it's just a crotch coming at your face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you just, perfectly groomed, you know, they have nice bikini waxes and they're, you know, all 6 of them are absolutely, you know, if they had a walk of shame, they wouldn't be ashamed of their bodies.
And this is too... It's just the worst kind of sex position, but I think my favorite part is that the High Septon wants to roleplay with kinky gods. Like, what?
I think it's supposed to be a little blasphemous.
And he chooses the stranger, who is just this chick with a backwards wig on?
Well, the stranger is neither male nor female, so maybe, you know, it was overcompensating, I don't know. The last shot is these 2 naked women walking towards him. And there's a shot where we have kind of like the High Septon is in the background, kind of in focus, and out of focus in the foreground is half a woman's ass for 15 seconds. Just half a woman's ass.
And the men are clothed in the scene.
Yeah, but both of the men in the scene are clothed. And then outside, when the Faith Taliban comes in and they drag the High Septon out, and he has his walk of shame. It's very funny because you see his butt for about 4 seconds. But every time there's a shot from the front, kind of everything below his navel disappears. It magically disappears. You never see it. And then when you go back, you can kind of see his butt again. But then
and
when
even
you turn
the
to the
butt
front,
shot, like
you,
the yeah. butt shot is seriously blink and you'll miss it.
Yeah. So they go out of the way to preserve the dignity of this old dude who's really into sex workers who are dressed up as gods.
It's just the 7 kinky gods. Like, why?
I know, somebody was really proud of themselves when they wrote that. I can tell you that.
Oh, that was so bad. I mean, my lowlight is actually kind of serious in that it was Marge and Tommen post-coitus. Coitus and post-coitus.
No, let's not talk about that.
We're not talking about his grunts.
No.
Just, they very clearly aged up Tommen so that he could have sex with Marjorie. Mm-hmm. And then they played it off as a joke. It was supposed to be really, really funny. We know it was supposed to be funny because Tommen would say things such as, I want to do that all day, every day. And, oh, little kids like sex. That's so cute. And it's just...
I'm always really upset at this because I have a son who's the same age that Tommen is in the books, and he has blonde hair and green eyes. I call him my little Lannister. So that scene really upset me.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just so... And again, Tommen acts like an 8-year-old throughout the rest mm-hmm. of the plotline, and actually...
No, that part where he asks her, like, do you like to sail? She's like, yeah, I love to sail. He's like, I like to sail too! It is exactly how an 8-year-old boy would act when he finds out that his dude BFF is also into Minecraft.
Yeah, like, it's
disturbing.
It was just so tasteless, and the idea that it's supposed to be really funny, it's mm-hmm. it's that South Park episode with them going, oh, nice. When Ike, the kindergartner, is in a relationship with a woman.
Yeah.
It's...
And what about that part where he's all like, I'm a man now?
Oh, right. She is trying to say, oh, your mother's so protective of you, like a lioness and her cub. Mm-hmm. And then Tommen goes, but I'm a man now. And he, like, looks back at the pillow as he's saying it as if, I am a man, this is what made me a man. And that's a fun parallel to another rape victim mm-hmm. in the show, Sansa, who is, you know, according to Ramsay, a woman now because of her raping.
Yeah. It's just fun.
Yeah, and what really drives me the most insane is that Tommen's age actually makes this plotline make even less sense, because why does Carol have any power? Why?
Well, there's some conflicting information about how old he's supposed to be.
There's conflicting information about who is acting as a regent. Mm-hmm. There's no Hand of the King, also, this entire time.
That's weird.
Which seems like it's something that should be crucial. So that is definitely my low light, and I think it's also a good low light because it is maybe the number two adaptational choice around which... I mean, definitely the number one adaptational choice for around which this season was crafted. Mm-hmm. But I think the overall adaptational decision prime... was Carol.
Yeah, the Carolization of Cersei, as we call it.
Yeah, and, well, she's full-on Carol Brady now.
Yeah, I mean, it started very, very early. I think you can trace it back to episode 2 of season 1, where that now infamous scene where she goes into the room where Bran is comatose and she bonds with Kat.
Over a dead baby that apparently never existed now.
Yeah, because she's only ever had 3 children and they're all blonde, so you know.
Yeah, too bad she listened to that prophecy.
Yeah, but ever since, even in the first season, which you know, even us book snobs are like, oh, it's okay. They go out of their way to make Carol to make her softer, to make her less kind of vindictive, less violent, with less blood on her hands, basically. Like in that season in particular, there's this scene where it's kind of a very iconic scene in both the shows and the show and the book of she goes to speak to Ned, and Ned is like, I know your dirty secret about your children and your brother, and she just basically says, you know, I regret nothing, and then she walks away. But in the books, what happens is...
It's the scene where she says, you either win the Game of Thrones or you die.
Yeah. In the books, there's this moment where she puts her hand on Ned's thigh and she basically offers him sex in exchange for his silence. And he rejects her and then she slaps him across the face.
Right. Which is a very telling scene about Cersei.
Yeah. Like, especially once you read A Feast for Crows and you see how she operates, like, you get the impression that this is how she's been operating for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's really funny because people act as if Martin retconned this awesome character and made a cartoonish villain. Like, this is the complaint about Book Cersei. But is it, no, guys, he knew who her character was this entire time.
Yeah.
You just projected shit onto her.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Because she wasn't a point of view character until the fourth book.
And right.
Before that, she was rather opaque. But she's always used her sexuality to manipulate men, and she's always had this kind of... Like, when she reacts
misogynist.
Very, very, very violently and very kind of snappily to rejection.
Yeah.
And in the second season, it got even worse, because there are two things that Cersei did in the books that they gave to Joffrey. And the first was when she had all of her husband's remaining illegitimate children killed upon his death. Right. And they gave that to Joffrey, full stop. And Carol was kind of horrified by the whole thing. And then during the Battle of the Blackwater, Cersei tries to get... Well, we don't really ever find out 100% who was responsible for that.
But it's heavily implied it's Joffrey.
It's heavily implied. Yeah. No, I mean in the books we never find out.
100%. Oh, it's heavily implied it's Cersei in the books. It's heavily. I think it's outright said it's Joffrey in the show.
Well, Carol and Tyrion both think that it's Joffrey.
Sorry, what we're talking about is the Kingsguard that tried to kill Tyrion and then Pod had to save him.
Yeah, during the battle. So in the books, Tyrion is convinced that that Cersei sent him to kill her. To kill him, and it's never really 100% confirmed, but in the show, later they have a conversation where Tyrion is like, did you send that dude to kill me? And she's like, no. She's like, well, Joffrey did it. And she's just like, what do you want me to do? He's willful, okay?
Yeah. And she actually acts concerned about him. Mm-hmm. No, and given everything we do know about Cersei in the books and the whole, like, Valonqar paranoia, it's very likely she sent him.
Yeah. Should we explain about the Valonqar paranoia?
You know what? We really should, because the whole issue with Carol, no, not the whole issue. She got this prophecy when the Maggie the Fox and Maggie the Frog prophecy, and the difference between Maggie the Fox and Maggie the Frog is that Maggie the Frog went a little bit further.
Yes.
And part of the prophecy was that after her children were dead, then the Valonqar, which is the High Valyrian word for little brother, was going to wrap his hands around her and choke the life out of her. So mm-hmm. she always grew up kind of thinking Tyrion might kill me, but, you know, she ignored the prophecy as much as she could, but then after Joffrey's death, she started thinking about it a lot more, mm-hmm. because, you know, is kind of, these pieces were clicking into place, right? And they cut that out of the prophecy. They also cut out the part where it's like she killed Melara.
Yeah. Well, there's, Cersei, like, Carol in that scene is kind of like Carol, adult Carol, she's always kind of very dignified and very calm. But, you know, little baby Cersei, she storms into that tent, she kicks the old lady awake, and she, like, you know, demands that her fortune being told, and she threatens to, like, have her eyes gouged out or something if she doesn't.
Yeah.
Something like that, or her tongue cut out. She threatens to do something very violent. She does that in the show, too, threatens to do something very violent, but she does it in this kind of very calm way. And
we're not judging the child actress, by the way, because she was brilliant. She was awesome. She was Lena Headey. It was perfect.
She did her job for sure. And when Maggie the frog said something she didn't want to hear, she pushed a bottle of sticky stuff onto her, and she like ran out without paying her. And then and then there's also the part where Melara asked for her fortune to be told, and she says, "Will I marry Jaime?" Because Melara apparently has a thing for Cersei's brother, and Cersei is pissed off at 10 or 11.
Yeah,
they're 10. Cersei is pissed off at the idea that somebody else would be into Jaime. Like, really pissed off. And then Maggie the Frog basically says, nobody will marry you. You're gonna die, like, you're gonna die a maid, basically. Worms will have your maidenhead, which is a lovely Martinesque image. And, and she says, your death is close. Can you smell her?
Yeah.
Can you feel her breath? And, you know, the poor child gets really freaked out, and then they run out of there.
And then Cersei pushes her down a well.
Yeah, well, Cersei kind of thinks that, oh, she died when she fell down a well, and she remembers hearing her screams. So,
Very strongly intimidated that Cersei pushed her down.
At the very least, and she did nothing to help her.
Yes. Yeah. It was an Alison Hendricks, if you will.
Yes. But our question this season is, what is the point of this prophecy at all?
Right, because they cut out the part about Tyrion, so they just left in the part about her kids are gonna die, mm-hmm. and someone, a younger, more beautiful queen is going to cast you down. And the whole thing with this in the books is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Everything mm-hmm. Cersei does to safeguard against Tyrion coming to get her, to safeguard against her children getting harmed, ironically makes her way more makes her position a whole lot worse. The lengths she goes to frame Margaery, because she's convinced Margaery's scheming against her. Mm-hmm. And she has no evidence, by the way.
None whatsoever.
Absolutely none. No, and she's even projecting, like, all the shit onto Margaery. At one point, she even thinks Margaery and Loras are having sex with each other, mm-hmm. because they look similar, and it reminds her of her and Jaime. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And seriously, all Marjorie is doing is, like, hopping around the city picking flowers and being like...
Yeah, just trying to be a good, like, PR person.
Yeah, she's like, you should come ride with us, Your Grace. Hee-hee. Yeah,
but Carol's concerns are all completely justified. I mean, yeah. You know, Marjorie is trying to scheme to cast her down. We know because she held a flashlight under her chin once.
Marjorie legitimately... had reasons to be arrested. Well, if, like, the perjury trap is stupid, but, like, she legitimately perjured herself rather than Carol, who tortured a bard into insanity for him to say that he had sex with Marjorie. And then she slept with another guy and then told that other guy, just say you slept with Marjorie instead. Like, that is what happened.
And Marcella's really in danger. I mean, she kind of got hurt in the books too, but, like, you know. Nobody sent Cersei a threatening package.
Arya did not say, you know what I'm going to do first. And the thing is, no one... I mean, Darkstar wanted to hurt Marcella, but he wasn't, like, a main actor. No one... That was no one's intent.
Yeah.
Whereas Felaria wanted to send Marcella to Cersei one finger at a time.
Cersei's response to this, like, not threat of Marcella, like, she just had this kind of vague unease about Marcella still being in Dorne. Her response to this was to concoct the scheme that would result in the death of Prince Tristane. Just like for lols.
Yeah. So. Oh, right. Cause it was, she invited Tristane to go back to King's Landing.
Yeah.
Because she wanted Marcella back too. And then on the way, people were going to kill Tristane, but they were going to be shouting, half man.
It made no sense. And poor Balin Swan had to execute this plan.
Right. This is what we're talking about with self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. This is her idea to, like, make Tyrion less of a threat and keep her kids safe. And in doing so, she just really fucking pissed off Dorne.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, Carol, basically, she has no blood on her hands whatsoever. She does, like, all of her actions are reasonable. All of her actions are completely justified. Except for arming the Faith, which kind of comes out of nowhere. Like,
it came out of absolutely nowhere.
No, like there's no preamble to it. There's no real build up to it. There's no like real reason you can see that it would make sense in any other context. But I want to pull one on Marge.
You know what? It was very so. The results are in. I definitely have breast cancer.
Yes,
that's what it was. And they're just like not really. Why did you do that? Not really talked about.
Yeah,
so don't worry.
You know she doesn't like you know spend all her time. You know, that whole thing that she does to the Stokeworths, that nothing like that is in there. Nothing like that, like her
Gosh, that's awful.
Yeah, and her whole thing with her girlfriend, Taina Merryweather, there's nothing like that where she's kind of...
We should do we need to do a Cersei podcast, just an hour on Cersei, because there's so much there that I want to talk about now.
Yeah, well, to summarize, because we're already at more than an hour, to summarize, Cersei has a lot of blood on her hands, and Carol has... more or less none. Even though nobody likes her still, like, show only watchers despise her and think she's a horrible person, but compared to Cersei, she is, like, pure as the driven snow.
And we can't tell if this is a case of they were really compelled by a villain, so they kind of accidentally foregrounded her into a villain protagonist. The things that she does are framed bad. Like, when she sends Mace off to Braavos, there is ominous music, and apparently we're supposed to think that that's a bad thing, but it's a really good action. So
yeah, it's a very good, because the Cersei of the novels completely ignores this problem of this huge debt to the Iron Bank, and it has very important consequences in the next book, where the Iron Bank decides to support somebody else.
Right, so it's either, like, Benioff and Weiss are just too stupid to understand the implications of what they're writing, or they're just so compelled by Carol that they're continually leather pantsing her and kind of enamored with Lena Headey's performance, maybe?
Yeah, I think, like, they're trying to imply that the reason why she's sending Mace away is so that she can have a free hand with Marge. But, like, first of all...
I thought they were setting up Trant to kill him. But then that didn't
pan out at all. But first of all, it was a really good decision to send the Master of Coin to Braavos to negotiate with him. And second of all, Mace...
Especially with his awesome singing negotiations.
Yeah, Mace is completely useless, and he was never in her way to begin with. Nobody in the show universe takes this character seriously. So why should Carol?
Even Olenna goes, not now, Mace. Tywin and I are talking. So yeah, Carol's just very, I think, accidentally... a protagonist. I don't think they I don't think they understood. I don't think they definitely didn't understand that they wrote Tommen being an abuse victim. They did not get that. So they couldn't understand why a mother would go to those lengths to protect a child and to arrest his abuser. But given that we're not idiots and we know that this is abusive, the implications for that, we can see this narrative, this strong narrative of Carol kind of being pressed up against the wall. She's dealing with this really toxic patriarchy and no one will give her any respect and her kids are very, very much in danger and she's
what was your
she's
meme?
She's doing what she can.
Wanted to fuck with Tyrells, accidentally became great ruler.
Good guy, Carol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like what they were trying to foreground is her catfight with Margaery, right?
Yes.
Like they were trying to portray her as being super petty.
Which is I think what they thought A Feast for Crows was all about.
Yeah,
if they read it.
Yeah, well, there's like a little bit of that. Like Margaery doesn't, like, you know, she's not a wubby in any way. So she doesn't like, you know, take all the shit that Carol brings, that Carol throws at her lying down. But clear. It's clear to any careful reader that Cersei is projecting all this scheming onto Margaery. Margaery is just a 16-year-old girl. She likes to hang out with her friends. She's, you know, a little bit sassy. And when her grandmother or, you know, her mother or whoever is just like, so we have the scheme and we want you in. And she's like, of course, whatever you want, grandma. But
she's smarter than she lets on, but she pretty much puts on this, it's a performance of idealized maidenhood. And she's very good at playing that game. And that's what she does. And yeah, every once in a while she'll take a small shot at Cersei and be like, who's ruling the other six?
But yeah, Margaery is not like Marge Boleyn. You know, she's not, she's not this like scheming sex pot.
And she's not yakking it up with her friends about Cersei's alcoholism and age. No one would do that. That's just rude. Well, actually, what is Marge Boleyn? What was she trying to do this season? Because we literally don't know.
Yeah, because, like, what is her motivation? Like, she wants to control Tommen, right?
I want to be the queen.
But why? Like, what does she want? Does she just want, like, pretty dresses and people to call her Your Grace? Is that the be-all and end-all?
Well, she has that.
She has that now. So why is she punking Carol?
Why isn't she in a position of power? If her husband is old enough to have sex and consummate his marriage, why does she not have actual power? Why is her
only
power?
She doesn't seem to want to do anything about it. You know, she doesn't have any kind of like social or political agenda. You know, like her charity work has disappeared. And
she needs to call her grandma in to do everything for her.
Yeah, she can't even have a conversation with her mother-in-law. So
that's the weirdest part of this.
It really is.
And, you know, I understand if you have Diana Rigg on your cast list, why you want to foreground her a bit more, but, you know, Natalie Dormer's no lightweight.
No.
They obviously are enamored with whatever she's doing, so.
Whatever it is. And the question is, are the Tyrells supposed to be the good guys?
I think that guy in the pub said so, right?
Yeah, I asked a random guy in a pub. And he said the Tyrells were the good guys, but he couldn't actually articulate any reason why he thought that was. So
I think it's just because the idea, oh, the Lannisters are evil. They killed the Starks in the first season, and they just bank on us sticking in with that mentality.
The Tyrells, like, they're better at PR than the Lannisters, but that's it. Like, there's nothing in the show to distinguish them from any other family in the show.
Which is maybe kind of a point in the books too. Dantos even says to Sansa at one point that they're just
Lannisters with flowers.
Yeah, Lannisters with flowers, exactly. But they aren't portraying any kind of ambiguity or anything. It's just, it's confusing what the Tyrells want. And then Olenna comes in and is like, I'm gonna start a war! And everyone around her is like, no, you're not. And she's like, yeah, you're right, I'm not.
Okay, you want to talk about the Faith Taliban and the High Grandpa now?
Yeah, speaking of people who are these the good guys? No, I'm just kidding. High Grandpa and the Faith Taliban are obviously bad guys, and we know this because they're homophobic, and homophobia is bad.
Homophobia is bad.
And they're just
so
a bunch
deep, Kylie.
I wrote a meta on this, on D&D's take on religion, and how this is really offensive that this is what they view. And I'm not even religious, and I was offended.
I was offended.
But, you know, the idea that they took this movement from the book, very, very quickly, the Sparrow movement was this populist response to the horrors of a war-torn country, and people kind of turned to the faith as their only source of recourse because the High Lords really didn't care, and it was, like, everyone that was suffering from this.
Yeah.
War is hell. This is explored really intimately.
Yeah. And it's all, like, within a feudal context, because, like, you know, in the feudal system, we love the feudal system, right, Kylie? In the feudal system, the main obligation of a lord is to physically protect, like, his peasants, his small folk. And that's what they failed at. And what they want is for the lords to live up to their feudal obligations, basically.
Right. Right. And actually, there's one point where they come in and they gather around the sept, and they're just kind of being bothered. They're a nuisance. They're kind
of... Yeah, it's like Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, exactly. And Cersei at one point says, I promise you vengeance. And they just stare at her and they're like, we don't want vengeance. We just want protection.
Yeah.
And so D&D took that and they made it into these just Uruk-hai who run around carving the seven pointed star into their head, smashing, I think it was false idols, but it looked like they were just like hurting poor merchants.
There is a passing reference in the books to them dragging one of the most devout out of a brothel.
Yes, one of the most devout.
Yeah.
Not just some random dude. Yeah. They didn't outlaw wine. Can we talk about how there's prohibition in Carol's Landing in a time period where there's not always access to clean drinking water?
Yeah, you think the water in the Blackwater is safe to drink? Are you crazy?
Oh my god. And it's what's really ridiculous is this whole thing is painted as this great progressive agenda because the homophobes are the really, really bad guys. It's like, going after gay people doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. But like, on the other hand, they have them being all progressive because they're like, you know, liberation theologists and they're really into uplifting the small folk. So I think that's their idea of moral ambiguity. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. But the thing we were talking about is, it doesn't actually make sense for the High Grandpa, even if he's this crazy homophobic whatever, it still doesn't make sense for him to purposely try and piss off one of the most powerful families by setting a perjury trap for Margaery. What does he actually get out of this? Because they didn't need to drag her into this.
Catch that dirty, dirty homo, I guess.
But what is Margaery? Just an ally?
He doesn't like them allies.
Where does it end?
I don't know. It's very odd that he chose to focus on this.
Yes.
Unless he's trying to, like, you know, dick wave how he can bring down a big family or something. I don't know.
Really, none of his actions make sense.
No, I agree.
The perjury trap, especially, because that required... I mean, the organization to set up that perjury trap also doesn't make sense, but...
Yeah, because, like, Carol and Batfinger and the High Sparrow had to be in cahoots, right?
I mean, Carol knew what was going to happen at the trial. That's not even implied. That's shown to us because she's grinning. But when did she? She had okay. So we should have mentioned this at the beginning. But it's a really major theme of this plotline that things happen off screen.
God,
so many things happen off screen. So one of the things that had to have happened off screen was Carol and at least the High Grandpa, probably Batfinger too, had a conversation saying, "Here's Oliver, a sex worker / squire."
He's a very industrious young man.
And he knows for a fact, he has had sex with Loras, or Fab, sorry, and he knows that Marge has been watching.
We don't want to besmirch the name of Loras Tyrell.
That's what we're trying to do.
Yes.
I like Loras. He's a good character.
He's very interesting.
The dumb Blackstone plot, or Dragonstone plot.
The thing about the High Grandpa is that, like, in all of their marketing material, they frame him as this, like, true believer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do.
He's the only one with honorable intentions there.
Yeah, that's... Right.
It's very
Such
weird.
Honorable intentions. But yeah, so off screen... Oh, also, Oliver was, like, delighted to be testifying, which was confusing to me, because he seemed kinda happy.
Yeah, I guess he wasn't that into Fabs.
It's really sad. They're my OTP. But did they also, like, have a condition that he wasn't going to go to jail or anything for his, you know, buggery and fornication?
I guess so.
How is that a real charge?
Well, homosexuality has been, you know, homosexual sex has been illegal in many places throughout history, and it is illegal in many places even today. But that kind of really started in the early modern era. Like,
yeah, the 1700s, 1800s, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, in the medieval times in Europe, it was kind of considered like one of the lesser sins.
Well, and... yeah, and then the Victorians, yeah.
Yeah, so. Not that means much in Westeros, but.
No, like, obviously, not everything is based completely on history, but we're just saying it felt anachronistic to have these straw men running around. And And the High Grandpa's motivations really didn't make sense. Setting up the perjury trap happened off screen for reasons still explained. You know, no, we need to talk about how nothing makes sense.
The idiot plot. Okay, this confuses us, okay? So, we're gonna try to break it down. We made very detailed notes for this section because we get really confused.
And we're gonna link this too. Julia and I made a flowchart to try and make sense of this.
Mm-hmm.
We had a full IM conversation for hours to try to make sense of one facet of this.
Yeah.
Nothing makes sense.
Okay, so let's start in the order of our notes. So, why did Marge react the way she did? You know, why didn't she use her own influence with the High Sparrow? Why didn't she use her own influence with Carol? Why didn't she use the popularity she had with the small folk to make some kind of effective anything in this?
Why didn't she at least go with Tommen in his wheelhouse?
She's super popular. The episode before, the small folk were cheering her name.
We love you, Marjorie.
Yeah, Queen Marjorie.
There are also shouts of King Tommen because he was just with her.
Yeah. She's like Princess Diana, you know? Like, you could tolerate Prince Charles when Princess Diana's there, right?
But suddenly her only... suddenly her only ambition is to drink wine and snark about Cersei's alcoholism.
Yep. And what is up with Olenna? Like, why is she making a suicide run? Why is she willing to go down with the ship and take Badfinger with her?
Yeah, I'm gonna admit to killing Joffrey just so I can punk you, because that will help. Oh, my favorite part of that too is Badfinger is like, "Don't worry, I will give you a handsome young man." But the only thing that doesn't even free her grandchildren.
It just punks Carol.
It punks Carol, and that's her solution to, "Oh, my heir has been arrested."
Yeah, and she's all, like, unwilling to do it, and, like, she bluffs about, you know, creating a famine or breaking off the alliance, but she doesn't do things. But from a purely Watsonian perspective, like, that's the time you go to war.
Fabs is the only heir to Highgarden.
Like, that was how Robert's Rebellion started, you know? Like...
Yeah, actually, literally how Robert's Rebellion started. In the books, when Margaery is arrested, and keep in mind, Mace has three sons in addition to Margaery. When Margaery is arrested, he brings his entire fucking army and will not leave until she's
released.
There's
two armies. There's his army from Storm's End, and Randall Raypel, just Tarly's army.
And eventually Marge is released into the custody of Randall, which makes a lot more sense than, you know, those ridiculous cells that they stuck them in. The torture chambers.
Yeah, well, she did have the whole sleep deprivation treatment, too.
But that's what happened just because his child was imprisoned and not, like, his entire family was threatened. I mean, we're talking the future of Highgarden here.
Yeah. And what is up with Olenna anyway? What is her job?
She's sassy.
No, but like, what is she's not the head of House Tyrell.
No, she's why Olenna is she Redwine. There? Like,
no, she represents them in an official capacity over the course of several seasons. She represented them in official capacity with Tywin, and now she is with Carol and with the High Grandpa again.
This is one where you can only explain it with a Doyleist lens, and you can only explain it with the fact that it's Diana Rigg.
But they have this whole thing where the patriarchy only exists when it's convenient for them. So they'll vote the patriarchy and it makes Carol look like, you know, poor set upon woman. But then they have, you know, Olenna acting with complete impunity and authority and everyone respects her. So
same exact thing about the small folk, you know, rising against the, you know, lords, but then you've got Bronn punching the heir of Dorne in the face and it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Dornish aren't classist.
Well, the Dornish are, you know, they're just crazy. They just like to fucking fight. Sorry.
Yeah.
We can't talk about Dornish. Okay, so let's talk about Batfinger.
Oh, my. This is the longest set of notes. Nothing Batfinger does makes any sense.
First of all, we talked about this in the Winterhell plotline. So if you want to, in the retrospective, so listen to that episode again. If you don't understand why the Sansa marriage strike and then negotiating for Carol's approval... That just does not make sense. None of that. That whole thing was just a plot contrivance so that Sansa would be at the mercy of Ramsay. Like,
so we have the handsome young men. There's two of them, right? There's one that he gave to Carol, who we assume is Olivar, because that makes sense, which they never discuss on screen at all. We just kind of have to assume it happens at some point.
We didn't even know it happened. All we know is that when... Littlefinger offers a handsome young man to Olenna. He tells her, "Oh yeah, I also gave one to Carol."
Yeah, and people are still arguing over who the handsome young man that he gave to Olenna is, but it's clear to both of us that he means Lancel.
Yeah. He said, I'm going to give you a handsome young man, and then Lancel testifies at the end of that episode.
Yeah. Why he has any kind of pull over Lancel, we have no idea.
Like, oh, yeah, there are people Lancel... still saying it's going to be Gendry. I'm like, are you out of your mind?
they don't think that far ahead.
No, he has pull over Lancel because they both peddled fantasies. So they had the bonding.
Was that what that scene was supposed to set up? Their, like, super tight relationship?
Yeah.
I mean, like, but, like Lancel didn't need any additional motivation to turn Carol in. You know, like, he's already set up as being super contrite.
It's actually a little surprising that he didn't testify beforehand. And if anything, if Batfinger told him to testify, you'd think he wouldn't.
Yeah, because he would be like, what do you want from me? Like, how dare you besmirch my repentance with your scheming or something? I don't know.
So yeah, point one, the handsome young man wasn't discussed between Batfinger and Carol. No. We're assuming it's Lancel because that's the only thing that makes sense. And we only know that it happened because of a scene with Olenna. But it was discussed off screen. The other thing, Carol summoned Batfinger down from Winterhell. And she basically just said, yo, we cool.
Yeah, but she urgently summoned him.
Most urgently.
Batfinger, that message must have been really, really harsh because Batfinger just dropped everything and left.
Yeah. And when we get to the conversation, Marjorie isn't even brought up.
I think what they were trying to do is keep it all mysterious and opaque and, like, make themselves seem like they have this really subtle plot going on by just not telling us things.
So she meets High Grandpa and then decides, this is our I Am conversation all over again.
Yeah.
She meets High Grandpa and then decides that she needs to summon Batfinger immediately because she sees something in High Grandpa that makes her think Batfinger.
Yeah, and, she decides that she can use High Grandpa, right?
In her she foresees High Grandpa. I can arm him and get Loras arrested. I could let her see those moves ahead.
But how did she know that she was going to get Loras arrested? Like, what did she have on Loras?
She just knows he's gay.
Okay, but then why does she need Batfinger if she already knows that?
I think she wanted to call Batfinger down to help set up Marge because someone needed to set up the perjury trap.
Yeah, but she already knows about Olivar if she knows that Loras is gay. Like, she has to have some kind of proof.
No, she just knows that Loras is gay because all gay people in Westeros fuck every stable boy.
Okay.
I'm sorry, she already knows Olivar exists because the Sansa marriage, when Sansa was supposed to be married to Fabs, and Batfinger found out for her through Olivar.
Okay.
That he had to have told her about Olivar.
Maybe he didn't reveal his source.
Okay. Sure.
Journalists don't reveal their sources. I don't know.
Okay, so Batfinger... Okay, let's pretend she didn't know about Olivar.
Okay, let's pretend. But she knew that that Batfinger knows something about Lancel, about Fabs.
She knows... Batfinger is the guy to go to for dirt on the Tyrells.
Okay.
So she needs him to help. No, she armed the Faith before Batfinger got there.
She did, but like right in that scene before she arms the Faith, there's like a close-up of his reply saying that he'll be right with her. Right, so obviously we're supposed to connect these two events.
Okay, so I'm thinking she sent for she sent for Batfinger so she could get Marge. Because he's the guy to go to get results, right?
Okay.
But when he said, I'm coming, she's like, oh, good. Now I can act against the Tyrells because I know he's on his way. So I'm going to get Loras arrested, Fabs arrested, because he was such a nuisance to me.
I mean, she's just so sure that Batfinger will have something that can lock this down? She's just that confident?
I mean... Okay, no, so then we have to go back to the possibility of her knowing about Olivar.
Yeah, so if she knew about Olivar, then why did she need Batfinger? And if how did she know that arming the Faith would lead to a perjury trap?
She needs Batfinger to convince Olivar to testify or give his information or whatnot.
So, like, Olivar, like, she couldn't threaten him or something? I mean, like...
No! Carol has a very specific skill set.
He's up for the same charges as Fabs is up for. Because they're, like, doing stuff together, right?
I don't even think Olivar was arrested.
No, he wasn't, like, you know, in the robes and covered in shit, so...
Let's just pretend... Maybe she thinks he has information.
Okay. You guys, you don't understand. We've done this several times now. It doesn't make any more sense than it did at the beginning.
And Marjorie wasn't discussed between them, and neither was Olivar! That's the thing.
Well, they think they're being super mysterious.
When they finally have a conversation together, all that happens is Badfinger goes, "Woo, you're arrested with the heir of Highgarden? That's probably not a very smart political move." And Carol goes, "Well, whatever. He was gay and I'm the insulted party." And then they just get like, and then she pivots and goes, "Lysa was fat? What's up with that?" Or ugly, I think, because
Lysa... She called her, like, reprehensible or something.
Yeah, because Lysa in the show is... Katie Dickey is certainly not... No. Is that her name?
Yeah, Kate Dickey.
Kate Dickey.
Yes. I don't think it's Katie Dickey. That would be a little too much.
Sorry.
She's a fine actor.
She did a good job with Lysa. A really good job. But, Carol just pivots to, like, making fun of Lysa. and then she goes, "Okay, if there's nothing else, bye."
And then Batfinger has to bring up the whole stuff about the North.
Yeah, because then Batfinger negotiates to get the wardenship, which doesn't make sense anyway. But what we're saying is, this cannot make sense.
No.
Because...
like, unless you assume that they're psychic. And, like, they communicate telepathically.
Oliver was not discussed. Marjorie was not discussed. However, somehow, Carol knew exactly what was going to happen in the trial, and...
they were scheming with the Hive Grandpa at some point, too, because he was in on it, too.
Then we've got Batfinger switching sides.
Yeah. But can we talk very briefly about her objection to the Sansa marriage strike and that how that really doesn't make sense either?
Oh, sure, yeah.
It's kind of the bee in my bonnet.
Why don't you take it away, then?
Well, the thing is that she seems super betrayed by this idea of Sansa marrying into the Boltons. And it kind of... it's not clear, like, exactly, because kind of this kind of equivalent, quote-unquote equivalent situation in the books is kind of like, this was all Tywin's idea, or at least Batfinger's idea through Tywin. Or Littlefinger, because he's in the books. I'm sorry. I get so confused. So the entire idea was that the Boltons would get a legitimate claim to Winterfell by marrying a Stark, right?
Arya Stark.
Yeah, a fake Arya Stark, but still. Like, the idea that marrying a Stark gives them legitimacy, and therefore the Lannister hold of the North becomes legitimate and becomes stronger, right?
If Tywin had had the real Arya and thought that this could have happened, he would have done that. The idea is to legitimize their claim.
Yeah, and this is actually good for Carol, because the Boltons, like, you know, she sent them up there to secure the North, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, that's literally their only motivation in this marriage. They outright say it.
Yeah, and, like, they're doing their job, the job that Tywin gave them. So what is she objecting to exactly? That it's Sansa Stark, who she wants to kill because she thinks that she colluded in the death of Joffrey?
I think it's that it was done behind her back, is what she's objecting to. She has a point.
I suppose so. But we don't kind of, like, understand what Olenna and Batfinger are doing there all together. They kind of popped into this plotline. They did very little, and then they left.
For Batfinger, I think it was very clearly a case that they needed to get him out of Winterfell. In Winterhell. And what else do you do with him but pop him down to Carol's Landing?
I guess. They could have sent him back to the Vale, I guess.
The brothel scene. The empty beds and empty bedposts. Why?
They thought we were really emotionally attached to that set.
But yeah, we didn't need any of these actors. Lancel could have testified on his own. Mm-hmm. Carol could have threatened Oliver on her own. And even said... I know about you because of Batfinger. Like, it didn't need to be this complicated. And the fact is...
could have been a Blue Bard callback.
Everything to make sense had to happen off screen anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to just invent an entire plotline that didn't occur.
Yeah. And another question is why Carol is bothering with dealing with the Sparrows at all?
Because the High Septon came in and was like, they slut-shame me.
But there's like... because in the books, she's forced to deal with them because they're doing the whole Tiananmen Square thing, and they owe a huge amount of money to the Faith, right? The crown owes a huge amount of money to the Faith, and once the High Sparrow is elected by, like, a mob, basically, he withholds Tommen's blessing, like, he won't bless the king until Carol comes and sees him. So she's forced to deal with them, right?
Yeah, of course. They're a huge nuisance. They're kind of a threat to the public order. It's a problem.
And I kind of argue that, like, she had no choice but to arm the Faith. Like, it was extremely short-sighted, and there was other ways she could have done that were probably way better in the long run. But the fact that she rearmed the Faith, like, it wasn't...
She didn't bring it up, first of all.
Yeah, it wasn't her idea, first of all. And It was kind of like, you know, a fait accompli, because she comes to the door of the sept, and there are these armed sparrows stopping her from going in. So obviously they're already armed, you know?
Right.
Like, this wasn't all her idea out of nowhere to just give fanatics weapons.
Yeah, he manipulates the conversation. The high sparrow manipulates mm-hmm. the conversation to go in that direction, and she agrees to it, but he makes it seem like it's her idea.
Yes.
Because he's a very shrewd man.
She is not.
She's a monster.
Yeah, but the whole thing in the show was her idea. She brought it up. She was the one who's talking about, you know, bad things happening to septons and septas. And the high sparrow just kind of sits there looking bemused. And how, like, what kind of idiot thinks that this is a good way to proceed for this extremely short-term goal of getting rid of Loras? Like, once you give fanatics guns, you cannot take them away again, you know?
I guess she thought it's a way of getting rid of him while keeping her hands clean, because Carol is all about clean hands.
Yeah, but what was her, like, plan for after she got rid of Loras? What was she going to do with these armed fanatics?
Profit. I don't know. Just, you know, hide her drinking from them, I guess.
She's going to make some gin in the bathtub.
That's my favorite part, is that we see her drinking more and more, even though there's apparently mm-hmm. prohibition going on. So hopefully we've expressed the ways this is an illogical plotline. Let's talk about how it's an offensive plotline. It's horrific implications time. Yeah, we need theme music for this, because boy, is it.
Yeah. There's kind of 3 points.
Yeah, one we already talked about.
Yeah, there are implications that they don't seem to realize. One, they raped a child and they didn't seem to notice.
No, in fact, they thought it was a hoot.
Yeah, and this was kind of the adaptational choice that shaped the entire plotline, because they had to age up Tommen, which means that for them to have sex, they had to age up Tommen. But for them to have sex, it also meant that Marjorie couldn't be gotten rid of in the way that she was in the books. It was basically like she was accused of not being a virgin.
Right, and they check for an intact hymen, even though that's a stupid way to check for.
Yeah, it's not a very reliable way. And virginity is a social construct anyway that has no medical definition. But anyway... So, you know, they do this extremely offensive thing, and they contort the entire plotline into oblivion to make it happen. That's number one. And number two is the wonderful gay stereotypes that we participate in.
Yeah, so Book Loras is, he's the ideal of a knight, you mm-hmm. know? He's the perfect, dashing knight. He's a wonderful fighter. He's kind of, you know, a bit of an egomaniac. We learn about him when he's interacting with Jaime, because Jaime's even realizing, like, he's me, just younger. He's kind of almost toxically masculine in a way, except that he happens to be gay. He was in love with Renly, and after Renly
he
died.
He is in love with Renly.
Yeah. And after, I'm just saying, because Renly died.
Yeah. I know that. He's still in mourning.
Yeah, of course, because after the sun sets, no candle can replace her. So he joins the King's Guard just because he wants to protect his sister, and that's, you know, how he feels he's going to make a contribution. He leads a heroic charge to lift a siege at Dragonstone, because there's a small chance that if he does it, it will help his family.
No, they're besieging, and he's stormed the castle.
Yeah, because by lifting the siege, it frees up the troops to help his family.
Yeah, because the Iron Men have invaded the Reach.
So he's a hero. He's also a, just, you know,
he's a great tourney knight,
chivalrous knight, that mm-hmm. is he's kind of the stock type of that, and then they turned him into a giant gay stereotype on the show.
He's like whiny,
yeah,
just having sex with everyone. Like, they only show him having sex with Olivar, but like the way he leaps into bed with Olivar, you know, like basically the first
and then the first
pretty face he sees.
Even the whole thing when they first have sex, how did you know? And it's all about like, ooh, we can't talk about my gayness. And it's like they strip down his personality to just be his sexual predilection.
Yeah, there's like every all of like the plot points around it, about him revolve around the fact that he's gay. Like first, like, you know,
which is amazing, because technically he's taking on the role of both of his brothers too.
Yeah.
So he's three characters. And he can't have a plot separate from his gayness.
Yeah.
And there's, like, spoilers that that's not going to get better.
No.
In the next season.
If the spoilers are at all accurate.
I don't even want to talk about it. So that's horrific implication number two, is just in this really progressive, pro-gay narrative, this was one of the most homophobic things I think mm-hmm. I've seen, especially with Elena coming in. And it's okay when she's homophobic because she's sassy, but
yeah.
Oh God.
And then point three is they managed to make the Walk of Shame gender neutral somehow. Like, how do they do that?
It's amazing because the Walk of Shame is the culmination of Cersei's yeah. arc, which is all about internalized misogyny. It's all about the effect of the patriarchy. And the whole point is that she was punished in a uniquely misogynistic way for being yeah. a woman. Oh, God, I can't. They made it gender neutral. They made the yeah. slut-shaming walk gender neutral.
Because that's how it works in Westeros, I guess.
Yeah, the patriarchy exists when it needs to.
The scene was very important. Like, they went up against an entire country for the sake of filming this scene the way they wanted to. It was yeah. very, very important to them.
Well, and what annoys me is that the gender neutrality was thrown in for the Walk of Shame. The gender neutrality was thrown in because I think they wanted it to be less controversial when it came up in the finale.
Yeah, well, this is one of those times where they should have like had the courage to just do it, right?
Right, but they also, you know. They very tastefully cropped out the guy, and then mm-hmm. we get long, lingering shots of Carol's body double.
Yeah, who's like 15 years younger than Lena Headey, at least.
Yeah.
And doesn't have,
flawless,
like...
Flawless yeah. body. And we need to talk about the editing.
The editing is hilarious.
So I really didn't notice the first time. I didn't. No. I'm not a very observant person. The only time I've ever noticed really bad editing was the snake foo scene. Mm-hmm. But... basically what happened is they wanted Lena Headey's face on this young, hot girl's body. So they used whatever program they did to do that. But I don't think they sized the image right.
Yeah, like they didn't change the size of her face before they pasted it on the other face or something.
And if you just watch it, it looks super weird.
It's off-center.
There's also like a lot of criticism from people being like, we know what Lena Headey's boobs look like. We've seen 300. It's like, okay, well, I don't know what to tell you for that one.
Yeah.
But well. The other thing is that had they cropped the shots, I don't think it would have been a less effective scene.
No, definitely not. I mean, like you can, there's a huge difference between like the cropped close-ups of Lena Headey and the distance shots of the body double, just in the way they're filmed.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the close-up shots are character shots, basically, and the long shots are voyeuristic, like, look at this full frontal nudity, we're HBO kind of shots.
Yeah, because I really think the close-up shots gave that claustrophobic feeling mm-hmm. a whole lot better than those wide shots. Those wide shots yeah. just looked
well, they had to show stupid. The entire body, so it couldn't be claustrophobic.
Yeah, but, and the way the body double was walking was, like, weird.
Yeah, it was just... I don't know why they chose that body double. I don't know if there's just not many women in Croatia willing to take their clothes off or something. That's not what I've heard about that part of the world at all. But whatever.
I think she's from the UK, the body double.
I don't know.
Thought I knew that. Doesn't matter.
It was a very odd choice. Like this is Game of Thrones. They can cast whoever they want, more or less. So the fact that they chose this body double is very odd to me.
They also just didn't need to do a body double, is what we're saying.
No, they really didn't. Like, I don't know.
Because it really, it wasn't gutsy, and it wasn't, again, yeah. it was filmed in a voyeuristic way, you're right, yeah. in that those long shots. But that was the scene that was non-negotiable.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it was your highlight, Julia, but did it make sense?
It didn't make sense because, like, well, it kind of made more sense in the way that just, like, the point of Cersei's walk in the book is that she's this horrible person, she's done these horrible things, but she did not deserve this.
Right. It's a perversion of wish fulfillment.
Yeah, because, you know, you, by the time you get through 9 Cersei chapters and, you know, she's wishing people to be raped and she's sending people to be tortured and she's just horribly ageist and ableist and sexist yeah. and you kind of hate her, but, like... you get to that part and you feel for her because nobody deserves that.
Right. And that Martin's brilliant at doing yeah. this, by the way.
And Carol deserves it even less. Like, a lot less. So...
the only thing she did that was shitty was arming the Faith to go arrest Fabs.
Yeah.
Which, again, was shitty, but it was also just, like we said,
nonsensical.
It was out of nowhere.
Yeah. So, like, you kind of can't really consider it because it made no sense. So you just have to kind of, it's an outlier of some kind, you know?
Yeah. But, yeah. And again, you know, her reasons for bringing down the Tyrells were pure also. Mm-hmm. They were legitimately hurting her children. They were legitimately scheming against, we know Marge with her perhaps was legitimately going to bring Carol down.
Well, that's not what Natalie Dormer thinks.
Natalie Dormer is told so many different things about the show.
Yeah.
Oh, the poor thing. She has to honeypot all of it.
All the actors do.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
The thing about, like, arming the faith is that it was supposed to be, like, you know, Carol's big mistake. That's kind of what she's being punished for. That she made this...
She caught in her own trap.
Yeah. Because she tried to spring this trap to catch the Tyrells, but then she got caught in it. And, like, you know, we've talked about how her motivations are different. And the problem is that, like, it was a stupid decision. Like, it was a stupid decision in the books for Cersei to arm the faith because it was so short-term. But it solved her short-term problem. You know? Like, she got rid of a third of the crown's debt. She got rid of the sparrows who were plaguing the city. She got, like, you know, the small folk think the crown is buddy-buddy with the faith now. And, you know, but in Carol's Landing, the violence just got worse. They just started being, like, vigilante-ings and beating up people in the street and smashing goods and destroying wine. So, like, the short-term decision to solve her extremely petty problem made the short-term situation in Carol's Landing even worse. So, right. When you compare these two decisions, Carol is much, much worse than Cersei.
At governance, if that's what you're saying.
In this decision, because in every other way, she's much better than Cersei at governance.
It's really confusing, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it's because... I don't know how else to say this. Because... I don't think Benioff and Weiss understood this storyline.
No. It's because they had this checkbox. They had these two checkboxes. They had to have her arm the faith, and they needed the walk of shame.
Right. Caught. And I think this is the thing that D&D are so good at doing, is that there's these conceptions that we know, and we, like, caught in your own trap. We get what that is a literary mm-hmm. device. So they'll, like, have that set up, and then not provide any detail. So, you know, all those scenes that had to happen off screen. So people can just, like, rationalize this into oblivion and be like, well, it makes perfect sense to me. She was caught in her own trap. Like, but actually, how?
Yeah. Well, what's the overall effect, basically, of this plotline? Like, what's the takeaway?
The takeaway is that they're smashing square pegs into round holes. That's my takeaway. It's the whole thing with, you know, two people stand in the room and they don't have a conversation with each mm-hmm. other. They just talk near each other. My biggest takeaway is that there's just so much deeply ingrained illogic mm-hmm. that it's very clear these showrunners have absolutely no idea what's going on.
Yeah, so you have, like, characters and they have to do things. And as long as it gets done, it doesn't really matter how they get there or how little sense it makes from a character point of view.
God, with this show, we talk about how it's the Emperor has no mm-hmm. clothes. And this plotline is that to a T, where there's just enough politics and smart-sounding lines, like the Petal Fantasies line. I will never not make fun of that. I'm sorry. And, you know, there's just enough intrigue because, like, there's that faith now and, ooh, isn't this interesting? And there might be moral ambiguity because we literally can't tell who's supposed to be the good guy.
No.
But it all just meant absolutely nothing.
No, like, when you compare it to Cersei's arc, it's just, like, it's not, you can't even call it shallow because it's not even, like, in the same ocean.
Yeah.
That's a metaphor. It works.
It's the perfect metaphor for Carol's Landing. God.
Not even in the same ocean.
It was just so stupid.
Yeah.
So meaningless. I think we've exhausted what we can talk about because it's, again, you'll just have to hear us go deeper down the rabbit hole. So why did Batfinger do what he did?
Yeah. We've literally been talking about this for a couple of months now, and
why did he go through all those lengths to help Cersei out, only to then chuck her under the bus? It's because of Olenna's suicide spree that she was on. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay. Well,
yeah, we're gonna wrap up. We're already way over time.
So, I'm sure you guys know that subscribing to our podcast is a really good idea.
Yes. If you have a really long workout, we're good.
Yeah, or three. So we'll definitely be back with our retrospective series. John's Folly is on
deck.
Yeah,
we just started on our fifth one, Deadpan's Bestest Birthday Gift.
Oh, yeah. And boy, is that another one that's promising to shape up. And
so if you want to reach us for any suggestions about future episodes, any questions, anything like that, you can shoot us asks on either of our Tumblrs, or you can email us at our email, unabashedbooksnobbery@gmail.com. Unabashedbooksnobbery is all one word.
Yeah. Oh, and like you also just, we still answer asks on Tumblr. This isn't just
we try.
Stuff. But if you have any podcast-specific feedback or episode ideas or just anything, we're kind of hoarding some asks for a future episode. So, yeah. And then also, do check out our new site. I would be remiss if I didn't mention it at least seven times. It is fandomfollowing.com.
Trying to rein in the Song of Ice and Fire content, but just we talk about it quite a bit.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. But thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thanks for hanging in there. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.